Hi, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also, in my opinion, what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with some of the best-selling and award-winning authors there are across the genres, all kinds of writers. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their yearly writers' conference. It's coming up. It's going to be in July, but people are signing up now. So sign up early. If you're one of the first 200, you get some extra pitch sessions with the agents. So if you sign up now, it's well worth your time. And you can learn about that at pnwa.org. That's pnwa.org. So, you know, it's a funny truism about writing, fiction writing, that sometimes things that occur in real life, in actual life, cannot be rendered believably in fiction. I'm not sure why that is, but that is certainly true, I think, of today's guest. Now, he goes by the name Bhava Ram. He used to be known as Brad Willis in sort of a former life, and he's written a book called Warrior Pose. This is his second book, I think second. It might be his third. Warrior Pose, a war correspondent's memoir. Now, I'm not going to ruin the story for you. We're going to talk about it. But his life and how he went from being Brad Willis to Bhava Ram and why he is even talking to me today and not dead, is what this story is about. And if we tried to write it in fiction, I assure you, no one would believe it. But it's true, and Bhava is here today to talk to me about it and why he is here to talk and not extinct. Bhava, welcome to the show.
It's good to be alive, Bill. Thanks for having me with you.
It is good to be alive, isn't it?
It sure is.
I have to remind myself of that, and I, at least to my knowledge, have never been at death's doorstep, but you most certainly have. And
it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, but I certainly did not realize it at the time.
No, we never do. This is what every single memoir ever written is about. Did you know that? I'm not to trivialize what you've done, but it's always, oh, my God, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, and thank God it happened to me. But let's go back
exactly.
A little bit. Like I said, your name, you were born Brad Willis, and you had quite the exciting life. You were a television war correspondent, isn't that right?
It really was the life of my dreams. You know, I came of age in the 1960s during the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, and I was deeply touched by all those struggles and really at that time felt like just dropping out of the world. I had a lot of anger and frustration, and to graduating from university in Northern California, I, by sheer happenstance, found myself with a job at a local television station, and it changed my whole life. It really gave me an identity because I could take that frustration that I had with what I felt was wrong in the world and actually foment positive change through investigative reporting and exposing white-collar crime and political corruption and so forth.
Yeah. And you were quite the daring fellow. You were really amazing. You were so fearless. Well, maybe you had fear, but you were willing to act in spite of that, and you really took yourself to the farthest reaches of very dangerous places, and happily, it seems.
Well, again, the career really identified me. It was so much bigger than me, and it was not even about a way to make a living. It was about a way to be a human being for me. And you know, from that little small market television station, I worked in larger market stations across the country, ultimately with the network news, and did war corresponding as well in Afghanistan and the Persian Gulf War in Africa and South America. And it was not a matter of fear or bravery. It was a matter of being so committed to telling a story and so fully in the present moment in doing so that it was always felt incredibly richly rewarding to me, no matter how difficult the circumstances were.
Right. So it felt like important work. It felt like necessary work.
It really did. Again, it really identified who I was. And I was very type A. I think if you would have looked up type A in the dictionary back then, you would have seen a picture of me. You know, I was in a business where I came from a very middle-class background, had a very middle-class education, and I'm in a highly competitive business with a lot of people from higher social altitudes and more prestigious universities. And I had no illusion that I had more talent or brains than any of them. So the way I figured it was I could work longer and harder than anybody else, and that's what I devoted myself to. That was my key to success back then.
And it still is to some degree, it seems like, because eventually you found yourself in a position where it seems like, as I just thought about it now, where you went from, in a way, shining the light on what you felt was wrong with other people or the world to yourself, because you reached a point, and you can describe, if you're willing, how you got there, where you couldn't do the job anymore. You reached a low, 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 low point. And what was that exactly?
Well, in 1986, I had been, inside Afghanistan with the Mujahideen freedom fighters during the Soviet occupation there, when we saw the freedom fighters as the good guys, and we had good relations, and went into the refugee camps after that along the Pakistan border, the biggest refugee crisis in the world at the time, 5 million of a nation of only 15 million people on these borders in squalid conditions. I was really touched by the children. Actually managed to bring a lot of them back to New England with me for medical treatment for badly burned bodies, missing limbs, shrapnel in their faces. And I took a rare vacation after that, very rare for the workaholic that I was. Went down to a beautiful island in the Bahamas. A big storm came up the last night that I was there, and battening down a storm window, I fell off a ledge about 12 to 15 feet and busted my lowest vertebra in my back. I hairline fractured it, although I didn't know it at the time. The pain was excruciating, but there was no way I was going to give up my seat on the rocket that my career had become, because I knew the moment I gave that seat up that there would be 1,000 people there waiting to take it, and I would never get it back. So I continued to work for 7 more years, hiding this dark secret of this terrible pain in my back, thinking, tomorrow I'll get better. Think of all the war-wounded children you've seen. Get over yourself. Tomorrow I'll get better. But I never did. And so I started using muscle relaxers and painkillers and drinking a little more heavily every night. So I'm completely pickling myself on this dope so I can keep going. So my career's upward trajectory, my mental and physical health are plummeting into an abyss. And I did this for 7 years around the world.
Yeah. But it didn't end there, did it?
At the end of that 7 years, you know, after the Gulf War, I was in charge of all Asia for NBC News. And I was in the Philippines covering a story in 1993. I leaned forward on a chair looking at videotape with my editor, and that hairline fracture split wide open. I kind of liken it to a pock in your windshield of your automobile suddenly splitting wide open, and there goes your windshield. Well, there went Brad Willis. I was screaming and howling in pain, medevaced out, major back surgery back in California, and it failed, and I was declared permanently disabled and confined to a body brace. So from a global life to this prison where I couldn't sit up to eat a meal or walk without a cane, now Vicodin, Valium, Prozac, Ritalin, and 5 other drugs I can't pronounce, and more alcohol, and a deeper and deeper abyss, because I had lost that which identified me. That's the important point. The physical pain was excruciating, but it didn't compare to the emotional pain that I felt.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, that is so profound that you made that observation, because, you know, so I do this magazine for writers, and I teach writers, and one of the things I have to teach them, and I have to keep reminding it myself, which is that there's you, and then there's your story, and you love your story, I hope, and I hope you want to tell it, but you aren't it. It was like what my wife was an artist, or trained as an artist, and her favorite teacher, we used to say to her students, remember, that's not you hanging up on the wall. there's mm-hmm. you, and there's the work. And it's so easy. Well, you felt like you no longer had, you didn't exist anymore in a way, didn't you?
I felt like I did not exist and like I had no future. And I was just plummeting into the darkness of nowhere. And I really became a master of self-pity without knowing it. I became a master of anger and a master of fear and a more and more difficult person as I went along, because pain changes you in every single way you can imagine. And then things did get worse, as you alluded to.
Yeah, they got much worse. And it's such a beautiful moment. You got cancer just because you apparently hadn't gotten the message yet, so now you get cancer.
I had a little boy born 4 years into being permanently disabled, my only child, and he was the light of my life. And finally, I realized, well, I do have an identity again. Even if I'm not whole and can't kick a soccer ball, I'm a daddy.
Right.
3 months into that beautiful life, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, metastasized throughout my lymphatic system from exposure to depleted uranium in the Persian Gulf War. And my doctors said, basically, write your will. You won't live for 2 years. So now add to all the physical and emotional pain that I already felt gripped by, and this incredible guilt that I'm leaving this little boy's life, that I have this death sentence, and morphine was added to my arsenal of pharmaceutical medications that I used to hide from myself. And I was now going straight down for a crash landing into the bottom of the abyss of my darkness.
Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing. So I would, at that point, death would seem very appealing to me. You know, why not? I mean, what the hell? What is this? But that was not the choice you made. And what's amazing is the choice you made in the end was yoga. Now, this is a phenomenal part of the story. It goes against everything intellectually we've come to believe in, well, not everything, but much of us in the West. It goes against everything we believe about healing. But you chose yoga. Yoga. So take me to that moment, because...
Well, it goes against what a jaded and cynical journalist would have thought a little bit earlier as well. Just after my boy turned 2, just before the year 2000, and he was my only relationship at this time, he came to me with tears in his eyes, and he finally got it that daddy was broken and dying in his own little 2-year-old way. And he spoke 3 words that changed my life. Get up, daddy. And it hit me in a place that I didn't know I had. Became a mantra in my mind. Get up, daddy. But how? I have a broken back. I'm dying of cancer. Get up, daddy. I finally decided that the way I would get up was to die with dignity, to detox cold turkey off of what was now 14 years of these terrible medications I'd been using to hide from the pain of my life and what I had become. So I checked into a hospital, cold turkey detox. I can report as a former journalist, all the demons of Dante's Inferno are real because they checked in with me.
Oh,
they checked
God.
Right into my room and tore at my flesh the whole time I was there. Oh. I crawled out dazed and confused, not knowing what to do, and worse pain. And the hospital invited me into an experimental East-West pain clinic using ancient Eastern healing modalities, modern Western holistic techniques. I didn't understand a word they said. I just said, I'm in.
Right.
The very next day, I did biofeedback where they put electrodes on you and take your temperature and your heart rate and your brain waves, and they play you a guided meditation. And this soothing voice came on with natural imagery and guided me to a place I've never been before that we call relaxation, true relaxation. And at the end of 20 minutes, all my vital signs were different, in a better place. And I felt a different taste inside my body. And it was an awakening that I had a role to play in whatever healing might be possible for me.
Yeah.
A month into this journey, they started me on therapeutic yoga. And even in my prime, I had been the stiffest guy on the planet. Now I couldn't even bend anything. But the minute I walked into that yoga room, I knew there was a voice deeper within me that had been unlocked by that little boy's plea of get up, daddy. that said, this is it. The cynical ego of the journalist says, this is what? This is nonsense,
right,
or broken,
right,
ridiculous. The deeper voice prevailed. I went back to the hotel where I was staying, and I ordered some of the ancient texts to be Federal Express to me, and I found immediately yoga isn't what most of us think it is. It's not getting our legs behind our head or doing different postures. That's a very, very small but beautiful and essential and very healing aspect of what I call the greatest science ever created in body, mind, and spirit of how to be a human being. It's about changing your whole life and making it more harmonious with the rhythms of nature and having a relationship with your deeper self and getting over your smaller self. So I embraced that because I had this intuitive knowing that this was my journey. And a few weeks later, the clinic closed because the insurance companies said, hey, this is voodoo. This isn't the Western double-blind study paradigm.
Right.
Not funding it.
Right.
Three people I knew in the program, two went back to drugs and alcohol. My best friend took his life. And I think about him almost every day, even today. I went home and built a yoga room in my house. And I started practicing all day long. I only came out to see my little boy. And what were the practices? Some very beginning yoga postures, meditation, visualization, breath work. More importantly, I fasted. I became an organic vegan from my meat and potatoes foreign correspondence diet. I called it organic chemotherapy. I took 80 pounds off my body. I did yogic purifications, which are intense. If you read Warrior Pose, you'll find out about some of them, your audience. I know you've read the book. And I took 80 pounds off my body. I took 1,000 pounds of emotional goo off my mental body. And I exchanged all my self-pity, my anger, and my fear, and all of that, and depression, for gratitude, compassion, humility, forgiveness, loving kindness. And we now know, modern science now knows, that that creates a different inner chemistry in you, and that that more positive inner chemistry promotes healing. We now know that a organic, predominantly vegetarian diet tends to help people get over cancer. All of these things wove together in this synergistic tapestry, and 2 years later, I was healed and whole. My back still looks like a total mess if you took an MRI or an X-ray.
Right.
But I practice every morning and I'm out of pain. I have no cancer in my body, and it's been 15 years now.
Well, that's incredible. And you know, on many levels. But one of the things I love so much about it is that you found the present moment. Does that make sense? You found yourself in the present moment. Does that resonate with you?
And that's really the journey of yoga, is finding your true authentic self and realize that we're all connected at a very deeper level. We're all in the same game together. That's why we call it a universe and not a multiverse. And ever since I had this experience, I've devoted my life now. My new wife and I founded something called Deep Yoga, where we anchor into the ancient wisdom of these sciences and bring it forth in what we feel is a very pragmatic and relevant modern context. And it's what I devote my life to. I've had the privilege of working with thousands of students and clients, and I have seen people access this lifestyle and change their life for the better in ways you wouldn't believe, which is why I wrote the book, because ultimately, while it's a memoir, it's not about me. It's about the power that each and every one of us has inside of us, from which we have largely been disenfranchised by an indifferent and mass media culture, a power inside of us to heal to our maximum potential, to turn obstacles into opportunities, to find out who we really are and to really own our power, live our truth, and manifest our fullest potential. And not only do I believe it, I've seen it again and again and again.
Yeah, well, you lived it. You lived it. I mean, you know, every story ever written is about some character suffering. They go through something. And and that becomes the crucible. And so you created the most intense crucible almost you possibly could dream for yourself in that disease and that injury. But the result was was commensurate with the suffering. I mean, the reward was commensurate with the suffering. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And, you know, I look back now and I saw people in these refugee camps and little children horribly injured from aerial bombardment or torture, and people living in unbelievable poverty. And there were so many examples of them finding an inner strength and a greatness that arose out of that incredible hardship. You know, if we look back, I think we found our American greatness in times like after the Great Depression or after a World War, where we really went through something and we were able to reorient ourselves as to what is really important and what we are really capable of. Anybody listening to this, you don't have to be type A like I was. You have a power inside of you. Believe in yourself. You have more self-discipline than you ever dreamed. I needed the power symbol. I needed that little boy to get back to the power that I had inside of me. But we all have this capacity to take charge of our lives and to make unbelievable changes. And
I agree.
It takes a crisis to trigger that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we do, because just like you described, I know I had a similar experience. It wasn't as dark as that, but I was sort of trying to live one way, trying and trying and trying, and it not working and it not working and it not working and not working, until finally I had to make a decision and say to myself, this isn't working. It's not working. I'm not happy with anything. I've got to try something different. I think everybody does that to some degree. I'm going to try and be someone I'm not. I'm going to try and be someone I'm not. I'm going to try and be someone I'm not. And then finally, how does that feel? And then kaboom. You know, what did you learn? So you probably in your teaching have told this story many times. It's a great story. It's a powerful story. It's a great practical teaching tool. And it's the story of your life. But still, you had to sit down to write the memoir. Did anything new come out for you in the writing of it that you hadn't already found in the telling of it?
Well, it did. At first, it took me years to write it because I had to find my own inner courage to face how dark I had become and to share it authentically and not try to paint a rosy picture of myself, but to talk about how difficult and dark I was in those years. What I found as I was writing the story was I could go back into my days as a journalist and realize, my goodness, my experience was the same as the little boy that I start the book Warrior Post with, who was burned with napalm all over his body and walked out of the mountains of Afghanistan for 20-plus days without any food, with burns all over his body. He found his power. This horrible event that we would wish on nobody gave him an inner strength that he may have never dreamed he had. And I witnessed that in a number of circumstances, in the Gulf War, in cocaine drug wars, in apartheid in Africa, where people who were really oppressed or harmed greatly or in war and insurrection, found that power. And that's usually what it takes.
Yeah. I've got someone on the line who wants to ask you a question. I'm going to bring him on and see if I think it might. Jeff, is that you?
It is, Bill. What an incredibly inspiring story. I will never complain again, I promise.
Yes, you will.
Wow. Yeah, I lied. Bob, amazing. I cannot wait to get and absorb your books immediately. I just had I work as an associate editor for the Deferred Journal. It's a very spiritually guided publication and community. My question was, how does your spiritual self, and I'm sure it does get translated in your writing, and do you go into sort of a sense of deep meditative state when you write?
Yes, that's a good question.
That's a great question. You know, yoga holds, the ancient Vedic practices from which yoga arises, hold that the most spiritual hour of the day is before sunrise. And I still to this day get up before sunrise every morning and do my practice. And so I made writing the book in this hour called Brahma Muhurta, or the time of the divine, because it is a place where we're more present, when things are softer and quieter, and where we're more likely to have a dialogue with the soul. And I wanted to write this book from that deeper place in my soul that pure presence guides us to, rather than from my ego mind that was the mind that governed the journalist that I used to be.
Yeah, you know, I always liken writing to listening. It's not thinking, at least not for me.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It's downloading and channeling. It's channeling what's really happening. You talked about pure presence earlier, and all practices of yoga are designed to lead us inside, to make a journey from our head to our heart, and to listen to the whisper of our soul, because we always know what's right or wrong. We always know what's self-help and what's self-abuse, always.
Yeah.
And if we listen more to our soul, that authentic voice will guide us in the right place, and that's the voice we should write from as well.
I agree. And I love that you went from being, I mean, I have friends who are journalists and they love their work, but there is a tendency within the journalistic profession to live from cynicism, to live from skepticism, to live from a questioning. But eventually you have to get into a place of, it seems to me, as just a human being, a place of faith in what you cannot prove, in what you can only know emotionally, know intuitively. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's so true. And, you know, now I lecture major oncology conferences at medical universities, and we have a ton of information now that shows that the double-blind study that's the traditional Cartesian model is often wrong.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of the real wisdom of the power of self-healing and body-mind-spirit synergy. And so it's more accessible now, and to me, it's much more real, and it's absolutely obvious and logical that if you eat better, if you relax more, if you exercise a little bit more, if you practice being happy and making contact with your sense of higher power, your life's probably going to turn out a little better than if you're dark and self-abusive and distracted and overstimulating yourself all the time.
I know. It seems very obvious, but sometimes we have to learn it the hard way, don't we? You'd think we all come in knowing it, I feel like. But some of us have to.
Especially me,
but now,
I had to learn it the hard way.
Yeah, but now you really know it, don't you? I mean, now you
know
it.
I do, but I remind myself every day. It's like sometimes in my lectures I'll talk about brushing your teeth. You know it, don't you? But you still have to do it every day or you're going to have cavities and lose your teeth and no one's going to want to talk to you up close. You have to practice every day being humble. You have to practice every day reconnecting with your sense of higher power, with honoring your body as a temple of your spirit. You have to practice every day with being content and happy rather than bitter and cynical and jaded. If you don't, you know, you're going to get bad breath of your mind and things are going to be difficult. We just want happiness and contentment to happen to us, and it just doesn't happen to us. And we now know in the most abundant, wealthiest country in the world that all that materialism and external acquisition doesn't make us happy. What makes us happy is finding that place of inner peace and wisdom in the spirit that dwells within. And all true spiritual paths lead to that very same place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a choice. It is just a choice you have to make again and again and again, isn't it?
I still have to remind myself every time I have no illusion that I'm arrived or that I will ever walk on.
Yeah. That's right. Good for you. Oh, Baba, this was way too fast. Way too fast. Thank you so much. What a great story. Go ahead, actually.
Thank you for having me. And anyone who wants to be in touch can look at deepyoga.com. I would love to be in touch, and I'd just like to let your listeners know, too, that we just signed a contract in Warrior Pose, How Yoga Literally Saved My Life, will be a movie in 2016.
Oh, that is fantastic. It doesn't surprise me at all. We have just a few seconds left. Baba, thank you so much. It's deepyoga.com. Is that where they can find you?
That's right. Thank you so much for having me. You're doing great work.
Thank you a lot. Thanks a lot. Wow. Yes, I thought to myself once, you don't find God once. You have to find it again and again and again with every choice. And Baba described just that. Well, thank you all so much. What a great show. As always, do what you love. Just find what you love and do it and do it and do it. And you can't go wrong. See you next week. Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.